Last year's Kentucky Derby was unprecedented in many ways. Instead of being run on the traditional first Saturday in May in front of more than 150,000 fans, it was held in September with no fans because of coronavirus. And for the first time in decades, a major demonstration was held outside the grounds of Churchill Downs, demanding racial justice following the police killing of Breonna Taylor. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll talk about preparations for this year's Derby, which has returned to the month of May but will be run with a limited number of fans. We'll also assess the state of the thoroughbred racing industry and Kentucky's equine community. All that and much more on this Derby Eve edition of In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, today is Kentucky Derby Eve, or Kentucky Oaks Day, as the fillies will be running this evening, and we're focusing our show today on Derby preparations, thoroughbred racing in general, and Kentucky's equine industry and community. And that brings us to Sarah Coleman, who has been the Executive Director of the Kentucky Horse Council since last October. Sarah, welcome to In Conversation. Good to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let me start. For those who don't know, give us an overview of the Kentucky Horse Council, what you do and what your mission is.
Sure, absolutely. So the Kentucky Horse Council is a nonprofit organization. We were actually founded in 1974, and we seek to lead, educate, and protect the development of the Kentucky equine community. So we are non-breed, non-discipline specific. We represent everything from the thoroughbreds to the quarter horses to the Kentucky saddlebreds and everything in between.
So you are a private nonprofit. You're not affiliated with state government.
We actually were originally founded. Our state horse council is very interesting. Most of the states have a state horse council, but the majority of them are focused on things like land preservation, trail use, things like that. And we were originally started as an arm of the government way back in 74 that recognized that the equine industry in Kentucky was unique and deserved protection. So we were originally a government entity and have since become a nonprofit, but the majority of our funds are still from the license plates that I'm sure you've seen out and about of the foal lying in the grass. Those are the Kentucky Horse Council plates, and those funds are primarily where our budget money comes from.
I see. Well, I know you do a lot of training, including livestock investigative training. As part of that, you teach people to recognize and respond to incidents where animals maybe aren't being treated well or maybe neglected or abused. For those of us who don't work with livestock and horses, what are the minimum standards of care that you expect to see, and how do you teach people to recognize when something might not be right?
Absolutely. So I will preface this by saying that we actually hire an ACO, an animal control officer, who comes in and co-teaches those classes with two other women here who are actually based in the horse park. It's Shelly Mann and Mandy Wiseman. They're over at the Secretariat Center, and they've helped us teach this class for years and years. But they basically teach all that livestock investigative training in particular is not just horse focused. We try very hard to make sure that we kind of cover exactly what you're saying, basic standard of care, recognize when animals are, you know, neglected or abused. And it basically comes down to their body condition score. How fat are they? Do we feel that it is sustainable to ongoing life? Do they have water and shelter? And of course, those are all a little bit different based on, you know, the animal in particular. We are actually going to go over to the stockyards here right across the street from the horse park, and they have graciously allowed us to come in and use some of the cattle that are in there just to recognize body condition score, go over very basic training like this is how you move a cow, you know, they move away from pressure, so on and so forth. We typically do two of those trainings a year. There's usually one out in western Kentucky and one here in the Lexington area. However, with COVID, we were unable to have any in 2020, and we're hosting actually just one, the livestock investigative training one, in the fall of 2020. So we've kind of had to piecemeal a couple things together. Moorhead is generally where we do another one of our trainings, and they are super gracious to us. They let us use all the different animals they have on their farm. But clearly with COVID, they're very conscientious about having outsiders, quote unquote, you know, come in and potentially endanger their students and their staff there, which we absolutely respect. But that livestock investigative training is a 3-day course, and it actually also is continuing education for some of the people who attend, like the peace officers and things like that.
Now, I want to talk more about the effects on COVID in a moment, but you also teach large animal rescue training. And what kinds of scenarios are you training people for with that?
We do, and that one is very, very interesting. We have partnered with the Kentucky Fire School in the past to help some of their firefighters come in and learn all these different scenarios. They do everything from trailer entrapments to horses that are stuck in, you know, quagmires or mud pits, to horses that fall down sinkholes. We also do usually one or two scenarios that are specific to events. So, for example, if there's a horse that falls at a large event and falls into a ditch, like of a jump, we work on, you know, teaching people how to get those animals out of, the horses in particular, out of those kind of precarious situations. So those in particular, that large animal emergency rescue training, we have a ton of people who usually want to come to that. We open it first to veterinarians and emergency personnel. And then if spaces are available, we open it for others to come in and audit, which means they don't necessarily get the hands-on part of it, but they can see and learn, you know, what our instructors are saying and watch as the firemen and different emergency personnel people work through those scenarios.
Now, we've had a lot of flooding here in recent months in eastern Kentucky. How has that, or has it, affected the horses in the equine community there?
It has. It absolutely has. So kind of looping back into COVID, we had, as the entire equine industry as a whole in Kentucky, had kind of braced for what we thought was going to be this influx of horses. You know, whether it was people who were losing jobs, who couldn't afford to pay for them, if it was thoroughbreds coming off the track and their owners, you know, with the shutdown of racing, if owners were going to have to, you know, not be able to pay the bills on those thoroughbreds. The whole industry was really, you know, prepared to figure out how to care for these horses, because again, we really thought there was going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of horses that would be in trouble. And we ironically did not have a single one that I know of in particular that was specifically in need because of COVID. The Kentucky Horse Council has a fund called the Save Our Horses Fund. We call it our SOHO Fund. And that is essentially designed to be a short-term band-aid for a horse owner who has had a financial setback, whether that's they've lost their job, they are hurt on the job and unable to work to have any income, anything like that. The Horse Council, they basically submit an application. It goes to some of our committees. And then from there, we provide feed and hay stipend, essentially, for up to 2 horses for 60 days total. We were really prepared. We're like, okay, we think we're going to get this call out that we're going to have all these horses in need. And we did not have an influx in owners who were requesting help, which, you know, is a good thing. But of course, part of us, you know, and all of our brains were kind of like, but do they know we're here? You know, do they know that there is an option here for them and that kind of thing? Because we certainly don't want any horse to be in need if they have the possibility of getting assistance.
That was let's talk more about the pandemic, because it's affected everybody, of course. But how has it affected horse owners, horse farm owners? Of course, they employ a lot of people. How has that affected them and their workforce?
They do. And I will be very honest. I had always joked around that I was like, oh, my gosh, the horse industry. Nobody ever really, I think, assumes that it would be the most stable of industries, as a lot of them are considered luxury items. And in all honesty, all of our farms were, you know, every farm that I know of, no matter what breed, what discipline, personal farm, professional farm, was very diligent about implementing the COVID protocols that came down from the governor, and they all operated. There were some tweaks to things, specifically like the breeding sheds. The way the mares were brought into the sheds was a little bit different than in years past. the horse shows that are here are operating on, you know, a no spectator policy. It's just typically the exhibitor and the owner of the horse and the trainer. We don't unfortunately have full stands yet, but it really, in all honesty, as bad as it could have been, it was the equine industry got off relatively unscathed.
Now they
with
have,
regards to the day-to-day operations.
They have persevered through all this. I know the racetracks and that industry, the thoroughbred racing industry, they've gone on with their competitions. Of course, a lot of them have the Derby, of course, last year being a prime example. No fans in the stands and very limited in terms of attendance. But they have continued to hold their events, haven't they?
Yes, they have. And they were – when Governor Beshear first came out and said that he wanted a return to work protocols, essentially for different facets of the economy to go back to work, the thoroughbred racing industry in particular was on the ball, you know, one of the first groups to really come forward and say, hey, we have a plan. You know, what do you think of this and what tweaks do we need? And the racing industry, of all the industries, equine industries in Kentucky, the racing industry was the first. Right behind them was the horse show industry here. The Hunter Jumper Association in particular had a couple board members who basically took the racing protocol that was approved by the governor and tweaked it so that they could allow horse shows to go forward. So it's a really good trickle-down effect. You know, they had the racing industry in particular had super, super, super smart people working on that to figure out, you know, how to allow them to return to quote-unquote normal as rapidly as possible, even though still we know that's not really normal.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're talking with Sarah Coleman, Executive Director of the Kentucky Horse Council. What advice do you have for people who want to become a first-time horse owner? Where should they start?
That's a great question. So there's a couple different things. If it's a younger person, you know, we encourage them to get involved in 4-H, the 4-H horse program that is in, you know, they have agents almost in every county in the state of Kentucky. If it is an adult owner or a potential adult horse owner, we would like to refer them to some of their local barns where they can take lessons and kind of, you know, get some hands-on knowledge of what is normal and not normal for a horse before they go out and purchase one in particular.
Well, as we begin, we hope to emerge from the pandemic and the light at the end of the tunnel gets a little bigger. What are your hopes for the future of the equine community and the various industries associated with it?
Absolutely. I think we're all really just looking forward to being able to enjoy our horses. You know, I ride at a local hunter jumper barn here in Paris, Kentucky, and their people who are coming to take riding lessons, they have almost quadrupled in the last year because it was one of the things that people could do where they felt safe outdoors, and you know, it might have been something they were thinking of trying. So I'm really hopeful that the equine industry in Kentucky in particular will come out very strong, you know, with a lot of renewed interest or initial interest in horses in general and what they can bring to people either as show mounts or racehorses or potential careers for some kids, things like that.
Sarah Coleman is the Executive Director of the Kentucky Horse Council. She's speaking to us from Lexington, as you might imagine, and the Kentucky Horse Park. Sarah, so good to talk to you, and we wish you all the best in the future.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. On this Kentucky Derby Eve and Kentucky Oaks Day, we're talking about thoroughbred racing and the equine industry. And joining us now is Vince Gabbert, Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Keeneland Racecourse in the heart of the Bluegrass, Lexington, Kentucky. Vince, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
Well, by the time this conversation airs, the spring meet at Keeneland will have ended, and as the coronavirus pandemic began last year, I believe the spring meet actually became the summer meet for you guys with no fans. How's it been going this year, having the traditional dates back and a limited number of fans?
It's actually been going really well. We've been very fortunate that our fan base has been extremely supportive, and we've, you know, we're about about 30% or so of capacity for our normal daily crowd, but we're sold out every single day, and things have been great. Business and has been good. Wagering has been good, and you know, the crowds have brought so much energy. One of the things that you forget, you know, in nearly 18 months since we've had fans back on the track, is just really how much energy you derive from having people here at the races live.
Now, you've been fortunate to host the Breeders' Cup Championships. I think the first one was in 2015, and again last year. Of course, that was affected by the coronavirus, but the championships are returning there next year, right?
Yes, sir. We were very fortunate that due to the limitations that we had last year, that Breeders' Cup agreed to go ahead and put us back in the rotation a little bit quicker and to reward the community. It's such a great event because so many of the champions that race and win for Breeders' Cup are all born and raised within about a 30-mile radius of Keeneland, and it really is a homecoming for those horses and the athletes that participate in the Breeders' Cup.
I remember covering the first one, and I think maybe there were some skeptics early on, thinking a track the size of Keeneland may not be able to handle this big event. Of course, it was a huge success and really a great moment in history with American Pharoah, and obviously they're pleased with it because they're coming back.
Absolutely, and it's nice to be the benefactor of low expectations sometimes. So, you know, our team did a phenomenal job in planning out the event in 2015, and even in last year when we had so many changes, there was no less preparation that was needed for what we had to get ready for the 2 days of racing, and we're super excited that it is coming back, and we hope that we'll be able to replicate a lot of what we accomplished in 2015.
Well, looking at the thoroughbred racing industry from your perspective, as you just mentioned, Keeneland, of course, is where young horses are born often and are sold and begin what owners hope is a championship racing career. So how bad was the impact of the pandemic on the industry as a whole from your perspective, and how did the overall economic downturn affect that end of the business? How do you see recovery going?
First of all, in the recovery, we're very positive about where we think things are headed. You know, the business as a whole remains very robust, and we were lost about 20% of our overall market last September as part of our yearling sale. So it did have a major effect. But one of the things that we saw beyond some of the shutdown, so everybody was impacted, of course, at the beginning with as things shut down. But what we saw through the summer and into the fall is that people really like to wager on our product, and I think we turned some new heads. A lot of May and June last year, we were really the only sporting event that was going on before the shortened baseball season and the NBA bubble season that they had. So I think we picked up a lot of new viewers and a lot of new people that wanted to play our game last summer that were able to bet at places like Oaklawn and Gulfstream and Tampa Bay prior to Churchill opening in the summer. And I think we opened our eyes, and we're seeing that now, that the overall wagering is continuing to increase on our product, and especially at the major racetracks that are able to offer good product. And so I'm very bullish as far as the future of our sport and what it means for the industry as a whole. And with the market doing well, we tend to very much follow along with the stock market and with all the projections of where the market will be in the fall when it's time for our yearling sale. We feel very positive about where things are headed over the next 12 to 18 months.
Did it have a big effect on the various farms and the breeding operations where, you know, they have a lot of employees, some of these operations that may have been had some outbreaks, but did you see any big ripple effect from that?
Not really, just because there's so much work to be done on all those farms, and it never stops. You know, the pandemic really hit in the middle of foaling and breeding season. So a lot of those foals were hitting the grounds, and those stallions that are, you know, mares already been booked to those stallions. So that cycle continues regardless. And especially at the time that everything began to shut down, you know, nobody knew really how long it would last. So that planning and that preparation and all the work that goes into breeding and raising a foal, none of that really stopped. And so we were very fortunate that our business kind of continued to truck along all through that process. And we really haven't seen a downturn in foal crop. And those numbers have stayed pretty steady from a year over year standpoint, the last 4 or 5 years and the last 2 years, especially. So, you know, we're fortunate that farming life truly did continue on and continue on with great momentum.
You don't have historical racing machines at Keeneland, do you?
We don't, but we have a joint venture with Red Mile. So actually we're 50-50 partners with Red Mile, the harness track here in Lexington. And we've got 900 and some machines, of course, less now with capacity restrictions. But we have the ability in normal times to have just over 900 machines at that facility.
I know they've been a big an integral part of with other tracks helping, you know, keep purses up and that sort of thing. And they were kind of rescued, if you will, by the General Assembly after that Supreme Court ruling kind of essentially put them out of business. But they've been a big help to the industry, haven't they?
They have, and we're seeing it, you know, in so many ways, the horses that are staying here year-round and what it means for the training facilities and all of the peripheral jobs that come with a horse population, whether it be farriers or equine lawyers, bankers, veterinarians, you name it, you know, you can attribute four additional jobs with each horse that you see on the track. And so it's the historical racing machines, and you know, we're very appreciative of the efforts of the legislature to make sure that that stayed on stable footing, because it does mean a lot, especially when you look at the other regional tracks, Ellis Park out in Henderson and Kentucky Downs down in Franklin, and it's a significant deal to make sure that we had that in place.
I know there's been a lot of concerns in recent years about horse safety, especially in light of the spate of horses dying at Santa Anita. That kind of got eclipsed in terms of, you know, just publicity and general talk by the coronavirus. I know you and Keeneland were heavily involved in talks about improving horse safety. Are those discussions still ongoing? Are those efforts still ongoing?
They are, and it really remains at the forefront of everything that we're trying to do here, and we're fortunate, along with Churchill Downs and a number of others, part of the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition, and the coalition was helpful in passing the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act last December that was really championed by Andy Barr in the House and Senator McConnell in the Senate to make sure that we got that bill passed and instituted. And it's, I think that is just really the beginning of where we're headed from an integrity and safety standpoint. I know that we've added a number of staff here. Churchill and Keeneland both have our first equine medical directors that we've ever had, that we've hired. Each of us have hired respective individuals to lead that team over the last 12 months. And you can see a difference in just the amount of attention that's being paid by everybody on making sure that we're providing safe surfaces, that we're doing everything that we can for the overall horse population, and monitoring that, both just safety and integrity all across the board, what that means, and making sure that we're putting on a good product.
Well, as we mentioned, when we're talking, the spring meet at Keeneland will have ended. We're talking day before Derby. What happens at Keeneland on Derby Day? You don't exactly go dark, do you? You have events there, don't you?
Yeah, we do. We're actually, you know, it's simulcasting, but it's simulcasting at its best. We're actually sold out, so we're basically doing the same footprint that we've had for live meet. We're doing on Derby Day, but on a normal Derby Day with no restrictions, we'd have, you know, close to 20,000 people here on the grounds that are enjoying the day and simulcasting and just taking in Derby from a different setting.
I know as we emerge from the pandemic, a lot of people, and especially in Lexington, especially UK football fans, are looking forward to the fall where you can make a day of it at Keeneland and Commonwealth Stadium or Kroger Field. I know that's a big day for a lot of people, and I know you and UK are both hoping that you'll be back at full capacity by then, but taking precautions still, right?
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that makes it so special, and, you know, when Georgia plays up here or South Carolina or Arkansas, it's amazing the amount of folks that come from the SEC schools and make a weekend of it. And so it truly shows the impact. You know, I know that, you know, football fans travel anyhow, but tacking on an extra day or two and between doing the horse country tours to be able tour farm, spend a day at Keeneland doing some distillery tours, it ends up being a long weekend for folks when they come up here. And so it really has a huge impact on the local economy that they're not just coming in and out and just spending one day, but they're making a weekend out of it when they come here.
Now, are you open for tours between meets at Keeneland?
We are every single day, and it's on our website, Keeneland.com, and we've got all of our tour information, and we've even got our behind the scenes upgraded owners tours that we've been doing as well, that allows people to kind of check out some of the things that are going on behind the scenes in the barns and what it takes. And one of the more interesting tours that we do is actually during our sales time, just because it's such a different atmosphere and setup to do tours during our sales. So we've had a lot more interest in that in recent years as we've opened up that program to allow people to tour the facility while our sales are going on as well.
One of the beautiful spots in Kentucky. If you haven't been out there, it's a great trip. Vince Gabbert, Vice President, Chief Operating Officer at Keeneland. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick. I really appreciate it.
It's time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Darren Rogers at Churchill Downs about preparations for Kentucky Derby 147. But first, to wrap up this segment, here's a Derby Week piece from the WFPL Newsroom.
I'm Laura Ellis. The whole world will be watching Churchill Downs this Saturday, but the track and the neighborhoods around it are still there, still working the rest of the year. On the podcast Track Changes, we teamed up with the Louisville Story Program to tell some of those stories. Here's an excerpt, narrated by Joe Manning.
Man, we used to run up down this alley, play racehorses, trees like this. We would take, I'm gonna show you. Break it off like that. Trim it down like this. This is the whip that the jockeys use. This is the flapper. Get in line, and they're off.
That's Sam Alexander.
Sam Alexander.
Retired jockey and exercise rider who spent his life in racing, touring the circuit. Sam grew up in a family of racetrackers on the doorstep of Douglas Park, a bush track in South Louisville, the older, much less glamorous step-sibling of Churchill Downs. He learned to ride early.
I learned how to ride a horse on a tree stump. That had actually real saddle on mounted on a tree stump with stirrups and a bridle.
By the time he was in eighth grade, he was galloping horses as an exercise rider.
And you only got 50 cents to ride to gallop them.
Sam started riding at another track in West Louisville called Miles Park.
We had excuses written by our parents to go out to the racetrack at 5 o'clock in the morning, take care of Naughty Jake, Naughty Nita, and all of them, and then the other horses, go take a shower on the racetrack, be at Parkland Junior High School at 8:30, eat lunch, do math, English, science, and leave. Back to the racetrack. And glory be to God that we all made it.
Sam's telling this story at Sills Lounge, at a story swap where black racetrackers passed the mic and talked about old times. Sam learned at the knee of other great black horsemen, like his uncle Tommy Long, one of the most highly regarded grooms in the history of the Churchill Downs backside. And Jake Batchelor, a black trainer from South Louisville, one of the only black trainers working at Churchill Downs at the time.
Jake, he used to tell me all the time, he said, man, he said, what you should do is try to get your jock license. And at the time then, wasn't any black jockeys riding. So I said, well, man, you want to make me the guinea pig? He said, well, somebody has to be, so.
Here's what you might not know, and you need to. 15 of the first 28 Kentucky Derby winners were ridden by black jockeys. But even if you've been watching the Derby your whole life, you've never seen a black jockey in the winner's circle. Because by the time Sam decided to make the move from being an exercise rider to being a jockey, the culture had shifted dramatically.
They call it the Sport of Kings when I was coming up. Now they don't even use that no more, Sport of Kings. It's a business. We wasn't raised like that. We was raised like to take care of a racehorse and the horse to take care of you.
This reframing of the sport as a business led to an infusion of more money. And Sam says, more competition for the work.
What was hurting the blacks then is that the money started coming up. That's where the blacks went out in the mid-60s, late-60s, early-70s. The money started rising. Then here come the white boys. Excuse my language, but that's the way we talk. Here come the white boys. As it started going from 50 cent to $2, galloping horses, okay, to $5, to $10, to $15, now it's 20. Now they're pushing the blacks out. We was here.
Sam says white jockeys just got better mounts. And even the best jockey can't make a slow horse beat a fast one.
That's just like with Pat Day when I rode against him. I never got to beat him because his horse was always better than mine. But if we got the same horse in the mornings, I beat him. You can ask him. When Pat Day come in the gate of Churchill Downs, he come in the gate, hey, Pat, hey, Sam. But then when he go get on his horse, Little E.T., who was getting on Little E.T. for he was? Sam Alexander. Who got Little E.T. to go out there and go 3/4 mile in 11.2 seconds? Sam Alexander. So therefore, Sam Alexander get on Little E.T., Sam Alexander gonna ride Little E.T. better than Pat Day ride Little E.T. Because you only own him one time. That's to breeze him a week before the Derby and Derby Day. I've been on him from the time he was 2 years old until he run in the Derby. Now, who knows Little E.T. better? Me or Pat Day? XI Boy, jockey. That's why I went from XI Boy to jockey, to prove a point. You cannot outride me.
In Sam's experience, you found the same unfairness in racing as you'd find outside of it. As a black horseman, you could work long hours, practically live at the track, eat, sleep, and breathe horses, but you weren't going to make the big money.
What you're saying is that many times back in your day, the black grooms were doing the work of and were as competent a horseman as the trainers.
More so. Because they there 7 days a week, 365 days a year, from 5 o'clock in the morning until 5:30 in the afternoon, the last dinner that they eat, last oat that they eat. Trainer gone home to eat his steak and salad. You eating bologna and crackers, standing there feeding your damn horse. But you the trainer. You win the race, purse $80,000, you get half of the $80,000 and come and give me $1,500. I mean, it's just the bitter with the sweet is what we always called it. The bitter with the sweet. And that's the whole thing in training horses and knowing horses and riding horses, is the bitter with the sweet. And that's what I've been taking all my life, bitter with the sweet.
I'm Joe Manning, and this is Track Changes.
To hear the rest of the Track Changes podcast, visit LouisvillePublicMedia.org/trackchanges.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Please welcome to the program Darren Rogers, Senior Director of Media Services for Churchill Downs, or spokesman as we commonly call him. Darren, good to talk to you again.
Happy Derby, Rick.
Happy Derby to you. Darren is, of course, busy preparing for the 147th running of the Kentucky Derby on Saturday. That will be 147 consecutive years because the Derby was not canceled last year despite the coronavirus. It was run in September without any fans in the stands or in the infield. But, Darren, this year, as we emerge from the pandemic, there will be people at the track this time, but a limited number to watch the Derby and the Kentucky Oaks, right?
Yeah, a limited number. You know, we stated all along that we were, you know, as we've done since last May, we've followed all the recommended CDC guidelines. We've had great discussions with local and state public health officials. You know, we operate based off of the venue and event guidelines. And, you know, we knew all along the number of reserved seats at Churchill Downs would be 40 to 50% capacity. We started out at, you know, in a lot better position this year versus last, we had a large, you know, we were basically sold out last year, and then we had to work backwards and refund and, you know, take tickets back, and ultimately we didn't end up having fans. This year, we're able to sell those reserved seats checkerboard style. So everybody will have nice spacing. There'll be boxes that are unused, and we think we're going to do it very safely and responsibly. The other thing we did was we delayed the sale of general admission tickets. We wanted to take a look at the numbers and how things were progressing. And when we made that announcement, you know, we have a low positivity rate, and you know, now we have what, more than half of Kentucky's adult population that have already received at least their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. So these are very, very encouraging numbers. The general admission in the infield, and it's the infield only. That'll be at about 25% to 30% capacity of what we typically had. You know, in 2015, for example, we had 60,000 people out there. If you do the math, it'll work out to be about 15,000 to 18,000 in the infield.
So you say you sold out last year. Of course, you had to backtrack. What's the response been to the change this year, ticket wise? I know you've been offering some, you know, some packages and that sort of thing. What's the response been like?
Yeah, you know, we've got a good response. You know, I'd say that we're going to have in the neighborhood of 40,000 guests on hand for Kentucky Derby Day. We, you know, have a 190-acre facility, and we're able to utilize by building around the perimeter some of the offerings, for example, in the infield. Rather than, you know, putting in suites this year, we're putting infield box seats of six. And then also on the first turn, we're offering bleacher style seating, very much like you would go to, you know, like a high school football game. And the ticketing over there, by the way, all the ticketing on the front side, there's no general admission on the front side. All the ticketing with a reserved seat includes all the food and beverage, and that includes alcohol as well. We think that'll limit, you know, touch points of the lines, people, cash transactions, etc. We think it'll help within the facility itself. So, for example, if you're looking to come out to the Kentucky Derby, you can get a ticket for $417 in the first turn. That includes all the food and beverage you can drink. And over on the for Oaks Day, it's $183. So we've got some good pricing. Obviously, if you're looking for a general admission package, it's more inexpensive to buy it today online at KentuckyDerby.com than it would be as we get closer to the event.
So for those who know Churchill Downs well, know that there is a community on the backside, kind of, yeah, a little city unto itself. How has the adjustment been back there to the coronavirus and coming back this year?
Well, one of the great things that we've done is we partnered with Norton Healthcare, and we've been able to vaccinate 1,200 people here. You know, all the backside, that includes our full-time employees here, and also some of our area neighbors in the community. We made that option open to them, and so that was important for us to try and get that done before the Derby. You know, the backstretch is still going to be, restricted area. We're limiting it to essential workers. There will be some owners and you know, that'll be able to go back there as guests. And then there will be media back there as well this year. But it won't be the normal backside, you know, party that we are accustomed to seeing in previous years.
Well, last year, Derby time, not only were we in the midst of a pandemic, Louisville was, of course, in the midst of racial reckoning following the death of Breonna Taylor, and led all of us, it's hoped, to look inward, and that includes Churchill Downs. How has Churchill Downs, the corporation and the track, and the Derby responded to calls for change, you know, in light of what happened last year?
Yeah, well, I think we've responded and we're listening. That's the steps. These are not things that can take place overnight. One of the things that we're doing on Derby Week this year is Champions Day is being rebranded as Champions for Change. We're going to recognize Black horsemen in thoroughbred history. Our stakes race that day, we renamed the Isaac Murphy, one of the greatest jockeys of all time. He, of course, is one of the 15 of the first 28 winners of the Kentucky Derby that was a black jockey. We're partnering with a number of different groups, such as the Legacy Equine Academy, the Project to Preserve African-American Turf History, Phoenix Rising, and you know, obviously we helped finance a nice exhibit that is long overdue over at the Kentucky Derby Museum. It's currently on display. If your listeners haven't had a chance to get out there to look at it, it is absolutely outstanding. It's a tribute to African Americans in racing. And we have another exciting partnership that should be announced real soon. I wish I could give you the details, but you're going to have to stay tuned.
All right. Well, last year there was also a lot of debate on whether, you know, the playing of My Old Kentucky Home should be part of the Derby Post Parade, as it has been for years, given its place in, you know, in history as it relates to slavery. The decision was made to keep it. What's the response been to that, and are there still discussions, you know, about including it?
Well, the Kentucky, you know, My Old Kentucky Home is the state song of Kentucky. And although there is, you know, no definitive history on the playing of the Stephen Foster Ballad as a Kentucky Derby tradition, it was believed to have originated around 1921 for the 47th running. You know, it's been well documented by historians that the lyrics were influenced by Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. And the original lyrics show that the initial working title of the song was Poor Uncle Tom, Goodnight. And in Frederick Douglass, he wrote his biography, My Bondage, My Freedom. He wrote that the song awakens sympathies for the slave, in which anti-slavery principles take root, grow, and flourish. So, you know, in the context of modern times, as you say, the legacy of the song is met with some debate, but it's currently the state song, and we're going to play it this year, and we will, you know, properly recognize it. As you said, last year it was played by a single bugle and was preceded by a moment of silence in which fans were asked to, you know, reflect on renewed hope and a more just country to truly, you know, take root and grow and flourish. We're going to look at similar things this year as well.
Well, let me ask you about racing a little bit. Of all the hundreds of three-year-olds whose owners and trainers aspire to get them into the Derby, probably what fewer than 20, you know, will be in the starting gate. Can you talk about the process of a horse getting into the Derby a little bit? There's now a Triple Crown, you know, nominating process, which is relatively new, right?
No, actually, it's the Triple Crown nomination process dates back to 1986. Mm-hmm. The three racetracks partnered together, and the reason for that, 1985, Spendabucky won the Kentucky Derby. And rather than running the Preakness Stakes, the old Garden State Park in New Jersey threw out a multi-million dollar race and enticed Spendabuck to run there instead of the Preakness Stakes. So the three racetracks formed, you know, at the time, Triple Crown Productions. And so we operate as one since 1986. Each year, right around now, there's about 22,000 thoroughbreds born annually. Of those 22,000, only about 1%, 1.5% of those horses will be made eligible for to compete in the Triple Crown races. The early closing of the nomination process takes place usually in the third week of January, where owners can make their horse eligible for $600. If they are not among those 350-ish type horses, they still can become eligible. There's a second phase known as the late nomination process, which is typically the third week of January all the way till, say, the end of March. And a late nomination is due of $6,000. Obviously, the closer you get to the Derby and the Triple Crown, the higher it's going to be. Now, let's just say there's a horse that comes out of nowhere, and he wasn't made nominated early or late. You can be supplemented to the Kentucky Derby and become eligible to the other two Triple Crown races for the hefty sum of $200,000. That's happened a couple of times in the past. That is not the case this year. All the horses that are targeting the 20 spots in the Kentucky Derby are currently Triple Crown nominated.
And the Triple Crown, because it ran out of order last year because of coronavirus. I believe the Belmont was first, but it will be run. The races will be run in their traditional order this year, right?
That is correct. Yeah, the Derby obviously is on the first Saturday in May. The Preakness will follow 2 weeks later in Baltimore at Pimlico Racecourse. And then 3 weeks after the Preakness, it's the Test of a Champion on June the 5th, the mile and a half Belmont Stakes at Belmont Park in New York.
And finally, Derby week is just the start, of course, of the spring meet at Churchill Downs. What's that going to look like this year going in the weeks ahead as the light at the end of the COVID tunnel gets, we hope, you know, bigger?
Yeah, you know, the one thing that we've said all along is that, you know, we're going to host our events safely and responsibly, first and foremost. But we want to have fun. We know Kentucky Derby Week in particular, and we open up on Saturday night, April the 24th, with night racing. And it's going to be in partnership with Fun for the Arts. We're just operating a little differently. Masks are going to be required. People are going to socially distance themselves. We've operated that as a community for the past year. So we're used to these different types of guidelines. But I would expect you to see fun activities here at the track. Opening night kicks off our 38-day run. Once we get past Derby week, Thursdays, eight race programs on Thursdays at 5 o'clock with dollar drinks, et cetera. We're going to have a couple of night racing events throughout the meet. We intend to operate as usual at a reduced capacity and safely.
And how long does the spring meet run? When's it end?
It ends. It goes all the way through for 9 weeks through Saturday, June the 26th.
All right, Darren Rogers, Churchill Downs, pleasure to talk to you as always. We wish you a safe and happy Kentucky Derby.
Thank you so much, Rick. Pleasure to join you.
To wrap up this segment, here's a Derby Week piece from the WFPL Newsroom.
I'm Laura Ellis. The whole world will be watching Churchill Downs this Saturday, but the track and the neighborhoods around it are still there, still working the rest of the year. On the podcast Track Changes, we teamed up with the Louisville Story Program to tell some of those stories. Here's an excerpt, narrated by Joe Manning.
Today we're with Wanda Mitchell-Smith. Wanda grew up in Highland Park, a neighborhood that used to run along the railroad tracks between Churchill Downs and the airport.
My great-great-grandfather, they called him Papa, and he had land over by where the airport was, and they would farm all of that property. It was sharecropping.
Wanda's memories of Highland Park are memories about family, and especially her grandmother.
Her name was Winifred Lucille Ford. Everybody knew her as Grim. Our pastor called her Grim. She was my heart. I was everywhere with Grim. They used to call me her shadow. She was just a wonderful woman and a woman of faith.
Highland Park would also become the home to generations of folks who worked at Churchill Downs.
Derby time was employment for a lot of people in Highland Park.
And that included Wanda's family.
My grandmother, my great aunt, you know, they would work on the track. My mother, you know, would take off from her job because she would make more in tips for those 2 days to be able to carry tremendously. And so they would work in the restrooms, making sure that the ladies' rooms and everything were spick and span. And where my grandmother's restroom was, you could go out her door and you would see the winner's circle.
Phyllis Knight was the first woman to cover the Kentucky Derby. She covered it for WHAS 11 with Jim Walton, and she was known for changing hats between every take.
When Phyllis Knight would need rest or whatever, she would come in and rest in my grandmother's restroom, change her hats, and go back out. And so my grandmother would keep all of her hats, you know, and everything for her in her restroom there.
When they were kids, if they were good, Wanda and her siblings got to go spend time with her grandma while she worked at the track.
Oh, we would be there with her all day. She would let us, we were allowed to go out in our bathroom, you know, and look at the races. But we had to earn to be able to go.
To go what, to the Derby?
To the racetrack with Graham. We had to have good grades, and Graham would lay it out, you know, if you do this, 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 and this, then I'll ask your mother and see if it's okay for you to come to the track with me on Saturday.
No way.
So during the whole week, you was making sure that, you know, that you did all of your homework, that you were in, you know, doing what you needed to do.
And they had to look their best.
We were always very well dressed. Our hair was immaculate, and it had to be. You know, mind your manners. Make sure you say thank you, please, yes, ma'am,
absolutely,
yes, sir. I'm thinking that this manner stuff is about respect on age. But when I heard my grandmother said, yes, ma'am, and she was saying yes, ma'am, to a Caucasian lady that was in her restroom that was much younger than her. And I thought, but you're a ma'am. Because for me, it was about age. For her, it was race. I can remember that. I can remember that.
I'm Joe Manning, and this is Track Changes.
To hear the full Track Changes podcast, visit louisvillepublicmedia.org/trackchanges.
That's all the time we have for today's show. You can hear this and other in-conversation programs at WFPL.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyrene Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Russell Wells, and Bill Burton. Our opening and closing theme was composed by Kojin Toshiro. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.